The theme of my presentation is measurement, and particularly psychological measurement in developmental science. I'm going to be arguing that good measurement is what permits scientific progress, that without it in science, we are not speaking the same language, and it makes it very difficult for us to compare results across studies, to talk about what's going on in development or behavior from context to context, etc. But I think there's a crisis of measurement in the behavioral sciences. While our neurodevelopmental psychologist colleagues have measures that can clearly be talked about as measures that have been well calibrated and are useful to them, in the behavioral sciences, we have yet to develop a method for calibrating measures, and consequently, we do not have well-calibrated measures at our disposal. The good news is that measures are constructed over time, that even the construction of the ruler, the yardstick, the thermometer, have long histories of development, and long histories of very intentional development by groups of scientists. So in order to provide a context for you, I'm going to start with a little allegory about thermometers, lead, and the periodic table. This is kind of a once upon a time story. The tale begins with an assortment of semi-mythical early scientists who had all made some ordinal observations about the melting temperature of lead. They noticed, for example, that lead seemed to melt at a very hot temperature, and that this temperature was hotter than the melting temperature of ice, for example, and certainly cooler than the melting temperature of iron. But with this ordinal observation, there were a limited number of things they were able to do. It was difficult to conduct detailed investigations into the nature of lead or other substances with these kinds of ordinal observations. And it was difficult to know things, for example, like whether lead always melted at the same temperature. So groups of scientists got together and began to develop what we would today call thermometers, or temperature measuring devices. And first that required agreeing that there must be some kind of universal dimension that was some kind of constant that was true across all of these substances and all conditions. And then developing some method for measuring that construct. So initially, there were several alternative thermometers developed, and the first of these it wasn't particularly well calibrated and didn't work very well in all circumstances. And so when scientists actually tried to test the hypothesis that lead might melt at the same temperature in, you know, might always melt at the same temperature, and they used this thermometer, they actually got different readings on the thermometer. And that generated a lot of other hypotheses, new hypotheses. For example, one group of scientists developed the hypothesis that the melting temperature of lead depended upon the context in which lead was melted. Another group of scientists developed the hypothesis that there might be multiple pathways to the melting of lead. But these questions really weren't answerable or addressable until further calibration of the thermometer was accomplished. And so consequently, they went back to work trying to calibrate a good measure of temperature. And lo and behold, once they had calibrated a more reliable measure, the melting temperature of lead began to settle down to about 327 degrees centigrade in our modern terminology. But then as the instrument became more refined, it was discovered that indeed there were small fluctuations in the temperature of lead depending upon the context. So, for example, depending upon elevation or depending upon air pressure, that you got these small fluctuations in the temperature of lead. Well, the okay. So while parts of this story are fictional, it's definitely true that the thermometer, as it was developed, has greatly contributed to our understanding of the properties of lead. But the important point that I want to make is that the value of the thermometer, as we all know, extends far beyond this particular use. So while the instrument may have been developed to solve a particular kind of problem, it has a kind of generality. It can be used to assess the melting temperature of any substance. It can be used to measure temperature for a variety of reasons in a variety of contexts. It doesn't matter what the substance is or where you are. It's a universal, unidimensional trait that can be measured on an interval scale. And it is these kinds of instruments that lead to profound observations. And I mean, it's only one of the kinds of observations that was made in developing the periodic table and understanding the nature of elements. But it's one of the very important contributing things to understanding elemental substances and a variety of other phenomena in our universe. But, you know, as all measures, it has certain characteristics or qualities that are important to understand. Now, the first of these is that measures are unidimensional content and context independent traits. The second requirement of good measurement is that we have to have a system for assessing the amount of the trait in interval units. As pointed out in the lead allegory, it's not enough to know the order in which substances melt, but it's important to be able to pinpoint them and talk about them being relative to one another in some way, and that's why it's essential that we have interval units. We also need a method for evaluating the reliability and validity of assessments. This is part of the process of metrology, of the science of metrology, where people work together to build instruments and have methods for evaluating the reliability and validity. And then finally, the end result of the science of metrology is the calibration or standardization of measures, so that scientists everywhere who are studying this phenomenon can employ the same measure and can create a common language. So, is it possible to have measures like this in developmental science? Well, I think in developmental psychology, all of us agree that development occurs, but we haven't yet agreed upon a universal developmental trait. In other words, we don't yet agree about what we're trying to measure, which was requirement one for measurement, so it seems like we haven't come very far. And needless to say, this means that we don't have a developmental measure. And my purpose in this presentation is to really ask the question, or do we? I actually would like to argue that a number of researchers working independently and sometimes together are building a consensus about a general developmental dimension, that we're finding evidence of this dimension in a wide variety of contexts. And that we now have the technology to develop and calibrate such a measure. So not only is there an emerging consensus about a dimension, but we have the technology available that's going to allow us to develop a measure around that dimension. And some of that work is taking place already. I'm also going to argue that the coordinated use of a measure like the one I'm going to talk to you about today can transform developmental science in some very important ways, and I'll share those with you later in the presentation. Before I begin, though, I want to address one of the roadblocks to the acceptance of a general developmental measure, and this is the persistent notion that complex psychological phenomena cannot adequately be described by isolating and measuring universal dimensions of performance or general dimensions of performance. So much like the contextualists in the lead allegory, that the initial group of contextualists who argued that that the melting temperature of lead was entirely dependent upon context, the contextualists in developmental psychology argue that there aren't any useful abstract general dimensions that can be identified and employed in developmental science, simply because all development is so tied to context that there's nothing that can be teased out that's general. So they view these developmental processes as highly context-dependent and fundamentally tied to particular knowledge domains or contexts. And that means that, for them, there just cannot be any general developmental measures. And so they would dismiss attempts like this out of hand. But I think we now have a fair number of examples in other sciences in particular that the only way to understand highly complex phenomena that are highly dependent upon context is to tease out some general dimensions that are measurable. And many of these examples are presented in terms of dynamic systems theory or dynamic systems models. These models make it possible to model very complex phenomena. For example, weather patterns are now modeled with dynamic systems models, and weather prediction has come a long way over the last number of years because of the ability to use these very complex models to trace and predict weather patterns. We understand weather much better than we did before. But I'd just like you to imagine what it would be like if a radical contextualist position had won out in meteorology. I remember when you didn't know whether you should bring an umbrella to work with you or not. You really didn't. They just couldn't tell you whether it was actually going to rain or not. And now weather prediction is so much better. So with these models, we can model complex phenomena, but there's a limitation, and that is that you cannot do good dynamic systems models unless you have good measures. So in order to really use dynamic systems theory in developmental science, we have to be able to construct measures that are reliable, valid, and accurate. Without them, the models end up not having a whole lot of meaning. So I'm going to be arguing, as a consequence of this, that rather than it being impossible to tease out these universal dimensions of performance, that in fact it's absolutely essential to tease out these universal dimensions of performance, and that without identifying, isolating, and measuring dimensions of performance, these abstract general dimensions, that we're not going to be able to have developmental science in the strong sense of that term. And in fact, we could characterize this, the current situation in some ways, as a Tower of Babel. Without good measurement, we just don't know what one another are talking about. And a simple way to think about this is you don't know if level 5 on one scale means level 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 4.5. On another scale, if you don't have a common language, and that's what measurement provides for us. Okay, so finally I get to the overview for this presentation. What I'm going to be doing here is describing the universal dimension of performance that I've been working with, which is called hierarchical complexity. This is very closely related to Fisher's skill levels and Common's general stage model, or stages in his general stage model. And then I'm also going to be describing how we go about measuring hierarchical complexity. And one of the reasons that I'm taking the approach of describing how we do the measurement is to help you get a better idea of what's actually going on when we're looking at hierarchical complexity. And then I'm going to describe how the measure is actually being employed to study conceptual developments, to develop rubrics, scoring rubrics for teachers, so to actually make applications that are useful in the classroom, and to assess and promote leadership development. And I should apologize in advance for the fact that this is new research, it's ongoing research, and we don't have all of the outcomes that we'd like to have to report to you at this time, but we're working on it. Give me a year and I'll have more of a story to tell. Okay, well, the story of hierarchical complexity for me begins with the notion of hierarchical integration, and I always do like to tie what I'm doing back to Piaget, because I think that, for me anyway, his thinking was the catalyst for where I've come, or at least the initial catalyst for the journey I've been on. And I was intrigued by Piaget's description of a process he calls reflective abstraction, which actually is a pretty complex process with lots of aspects to it. But one aspect of this process is the notion that new knowledge is constructed from already existing knowledge, so that we take what we know and we can recombine it in new ways to come up with novel new constructions, new concepts. And the process of reflective abstraction results in something that we think about as hierarchical integration. So you take these elements of a level that you're thinking at right now, you recombine them at a new level, and that has a hierarchical quality, and there's a new integration that takes place at this new level. Hierarchical integration is observable as hierarchical complexity. So when I talk about hierarchical complexity, I'm talking about an observable phenomenon, something that can be observed in performance. And I think this is a very important distinction to make. I'm not necessarily, when I look at hierarchical complexity, thinking that I'm looking at a feature of a person. I'm looking at a feature of performance. And for any individual, there are a number of different factors that can influence what a particular performance is going to look like. So, though what I'm talking about here is a ruler called hierarchical complexity, I'm not treating people as though they are people in positions along a ruler. So what does hierarchical complexity look like? Well, my colleagues and I have tried to find a number of ways to show people what hierarchical complexity looks like. I'm going to provide you with a couple of options here and see if we can capture everybody's understanding in this way. This is a new way that we've developed recently to try to think about what hierarchical complexity looks like. Borrowing from things that have been going on in cognitive science with concept maps, and we decided it might be useful to start mapping concepts out with concept maps to help us better understand what we're looking at when we're looking at structure. So here we have a construct of the notion of a good leader at what we call the abstract mappings complexity order. And you can see, looking at this image right away, that this argument has a kind of linear structure. This individual is arguing that a good leader is one who supports the mission by getting people organized so they can work efficiently and the work gets done in a timely fashion. So this is what we call a mapping. It's a linear kind of argument with a series of abstractions connected together through relations. Here's a second example. A good leader is one who takes care of people by listening to what they have to say so they will feel loyal, so they feel like their ideas are important. Notice that this argument has an identical structure to the initial argument, but a very different meaning. So when we're talking about hierarchical complexity, we're not talking about the particular meaning that's embodied in someone's construction. We're talking about the form of the construction. And in this case, the form of these constructions, they're both at abstract mappings. So in a way, in a sense, we're kind of looking through the particular concepts to that underlying structure, and that's how we come up with an assessment of the complexity order. Now, hierarchical integration involves taking the constructs you have at a particular complexity order and integrating them in some way. And so here is a highly idealized integration of the two constructions that I just presented to you. Here we have what I would say is a qualitatively new conception of good leader. Person still using the same term, they're saying a good leader is, but it has a qualitatively different meaning. Because now, rather than it being about either someone who supports the mission or someone who takes care of people, this person's saying you have to have both. Both of these things are necessary for good leadership. And both of them require listening to what people have to say and getting people organized as conditions for being able to accomplish those goals. And here we have the whole set of outputs from the abstract mappings conceptions. In reality, what you would see in a real example were new outputs because you have a qualitatively new conception, but I haven't shown any new outputs here. Here's another way of looking at hierarchical complexity borrowed from my colleague Kurt Fischer. in this example, or in this schematic, if we start with level one, at the very top of the screen, we have a single element, a little dot, and that would be the first level. The next order of complexity would actually be a kind of integration because it would take two elements and connect them through a relation. At the third level, we have a system because we have multiple elements connected together in a systematic relation. And at the fourth level, we have something more than a system, a new level of dimensionality. And when this takes place, we talk about having a brand new element. So the fourth level of the first series becomes the first level of the next series. And then that construction process begins again. And this is a pattern that repeats itself across the course of development. Okay, so let's talk about how hierarchical complexity actually manifests in performance. It actually manifests in two ways in text performances that we've been focusing on these two ways. In actuality, I say it manifests in two ways. It really manifests in only one way, but there are two ways in which we can look at it in text performances. So I think it's important to pay attention to this first way it manifests and get this, and then it's easier to get the second way in which it manifests. The first way it manifests is through the logical structure of a performance, and that's what you saw in the mappings that I just showed you. The form of the argument, the way in which the form of arguments, tasks, and procedures. And this refers to the way in which the elements of an argument, those things that were in the boxes in the diagrams I showed you, are coordinated with one another, are related to one another. Okay, so then there's another level at which we observe logical structure. And this is in what we call hierarchical order of abstraction. And the difference between the observation of logical structure in the first instance and the observation of logical structure in the second instance is that now we actually have to infer logical structure rather than being able to observe it directly, because we're looking at the elements of arguments, tasks, and procedures. We're looking at the logical form of the elements themselves. And this is not always made explicit in performance, so sometimes we have to make inferences. And the way that we do that is we try to infer the meaning and how that meaning might have been constructed. So this is about the conceptual structure of the elements in a performance, and it's just another layer that we look at when we're trying to determine the hierarchical complexity of a performance. Okay. This next slide is a table that describes the logical structure of complexity orders from single representations to single principles. And this is only represents 7 of the complexity orders. There are 13 in total, and they go from birth all the way through adulthood. The segment of the developmental continuum that we're looking at here goes from about age 2.5 or 3, depending upon the child, through adulthood. And the reason that we've selected this particular area of the developmental continuum to focus on is because this is where speech becomes a way of looking at the structure of performance. Prior to that, it's really necessary to look at other kinds of behaviors. I mean, it's possible to look at other kinds of behaviors throughout the developmental continuum, but we've mostly been looking at speech performances. So that's why we're focusing here on this segment of the continuum. So at single representations, looking at the bottom of the table, we talk about the logical structure of performance as being definitional, or focusing on single elements. So you get constructions here like, I know my ABCs. So ABCs is kind of a single aspect of knowing here. If there's not really a relation between these two things, it's almost an identity. They're equivalent to one another. At the representational mappings order, the structure becomes linear, or has the structure of mappings or relations. And we get constructions here like, my dad will take me camping because he will keep his promise. And here the structure is coordinating two representations. And it's a real relation between those two representations. This is not like the kind of identity we saw at the first level. It's a real relation. So knowing about that you're going to get to go camping has to do with understanding that your father is going to keep a promise. At the next complexity order, representational systems, the logical structure is multivariate. We see here systems of relations. And here we get constructions like, a fact is like I go to school every day and Tommy is my best friend and I hate broccoli. So here you begin to see concepts defined in terms of multiple instances, so like categories that contain multiple instances of things that are related to one another, but related to one another on the basis of kind of representational features. Then we can move to single abstractions, and note here we go back to where we started with single representations in terms of the structure, and we're defining the structure in exactly the same way. We have a definitional structure. We're looking at single elements again. And here we get constructions like, I have proof, so I know it's a fact. And notice here that the relationship between proof and fact is like an identity again. There's not really any kind of logical relation specified between the two. One is just used as a definition for the other in some sense. Moving to abstract mappings. The structure is linear, and we again see mappings or relations emerge, and you saw some examples of those mapped out earlier. Here's another example. Having evidence isn't the same thing as having proof. That's why there are innocent people in jail. So you notice here that the structure has really changed from the single abstractions definitional structure. We have two abstract concepts that are linked together in a logical relation to come to a conclusion about how innocent people end up in jail. And again, at the abstract systems level, we see a multivariate structure with systems of relations and constructs like validating evidence is a complex process involving evaluations of sources, data gathering techniques, and analytical methods. So here, the business of validating evidence is construed as a system that involves coordinating a range of abstract techniques and approaches to the process of gathering evidence and analyzing evidence. Finally, at single principles, we talk about the logical structure as being definitional again, so we've arrived at a new tier. And an example of a single principle argument would be something like, in the end, the search for truth cannot rest on empirical validity alone. The search requires an integration of philosophical and empirical validity claims. So in this case, the principle, it doesn't come out of this as clearly as a single word as it does at some of the other levels, but there's a principle here that involves the necessity of integrating these two systems of thought to actually be able to conduct an adequate search for truth. So that principle is about integrating these two systems. So now I want to talk to you about hierarchical order of abstraction, which, again, I want to say that we're really still talking about logical structure. We're not actually talking about something that's completely distinct. Parsing these two things out is a heuristic device. It makes it easier for us to examine the logical structure of arguments and to make sense of them and to make more precise measurements. But, you know, they're really very closely interrelated and, in fact, the same thing, just seen in a different form. So there are five. It turns out that there are five primary orders of abstraction in the developmental continuum. And I take this from Fisher, though some of my terminology is not exactly the same. They start out with reflexive actions, go to sensory motor schemes, then representations, then abstractions, and then principles or axioms. And if you can refer back to the diagram that I showed you with the little elements and building on one another, the emergence of each of these is related to that moment when you have that level four with the emergent and level one sitting there together side by side in the diagram. So the new kind of conceptual form is what's emerging at the point where you get level four in every case. So we've got, in a sense, five tiers. And each of these tiers results in the emergence of a new kind of concept. For the purposes of scoring and in thinking and thinking in deeper ways about hierarchical complexity, we've also identified three secondary orders of abstraction, first order, second order, and third order abstractions. And these are embedded within each of these tiers. So reflexive actions, for example, is associated with three orders of abstraction. And the only level that's not associated with, the only tier that's not associated with three levels of abstraction is the principles axioms tier, and that's because we simply haven't figured out whether it's possible to look at a performance and identify second or third order abstractions yet. Okay, so when we think about hierarchical order of abstraction, we're really talking about conceptual structure. So I've got the same kind of table here that I showed you before with logical structure. It extends only from single representations to single principles. And you'll notice that there's some pretty fancy color coding here in this table. That's not particularly important for our interpretation of the table right now, but it's going to be important on the second slide. So go ahead and let yourself familiarize yourself with this color scheme. It might be helpful in a couple of minutes. So when we talk about conceptual structure, we use a different terminology than when we're talking about logical structure. And this is really, again, it's a heuristic device. It helps us to kind of keep these two parsed out when we're doing our scoring or when we're thinking about the structure of arguments. In fact, for example, looking at the single representations order, first order representations which coordinate sensory motor systems, which are the constructions of the previous order, first-order representations really are single representations. So there's an identity in the definition between the name of the level and the name of the order of abstraction. But we need to have two separate names for reasons that don't really become apparent until you're actually using the scoring system. So you kind of have to take it on faith that we need those names, those separate names. And so at first-order representations, we begin to see the emergence in the domain that we're exploring here, which is the epistemological domain, of concepts and very early precursor concepts of, like, know, learn, teach, think, and wrong. And it's important to keep in mind that these are very early versions of these concepts. They're not elaborated in the same way that you or I would elaborate them. But these lexical items begin to appear in speech, and they do have meanings attached to them that are meaningful and useful, and they're used in appropriate ways by these children at this order. And then at the next level, representational mappings, we call the conceptual structure second-order representations. And these are said to coordinate or modify single representations. So you should be seeing a pattern emerging here. At each new level, there's a coordination of the concepts of the previous level. And here we see the emergence of concepts like believe, correct, guess, lie, probably, promise, question, and real. At the representational systems order, we see third-order representations, which coordinate elements of representational systems. And here, constructs like argument, certain, doubt, explain, fact, honest, imagine, possible, and trust emerge for the first time. As single abstractions, we go back to single order because we've started a new tier. So single abstractions are first-order abstractions which coordinate representational systems. And here we see the emergence of constructs like cause, compare, competent, deceive, imaginary, logical, and proof. Now, by now, I know that people who are in the audience are thinking, yeah, so how do you know these emergent this time? How did you find this out? How did you figure this out? Well, actually, we do have empirical evidence that these lexical items don't emerge until these complexity orders. We've been studying for several years now how the lexicon actually changes with development. And on the next slide, I'm going to be showing you why we think this happens. But for now, yes, we do have empirical evidence for the emergence of these constructs in this order and in this way. So at abstract mappings, second order abstractions, which coordinate or modify single abstractions, and we see things like basis, certainty, comparison, confirm, determinant, evidence appear. And then at abstract systems, where we have third-order abstractions, which coordinate elements of abstract systems, we have causality, discourse, empirical, spurious, validate, and veracity. At single principles, I've left it blank And I know I'm going to get in trouble for this because I've gotten in trouble for this before. and I've left it blank because on the level of conceptual structure, it's not as clear at single principles that we have unique lexical items emerging. And most of the things I can think of are just very confusing because they're items that also can be used at lower complexity orders. So I'm not going to provide you with lexical items for the conceptual structure of single principles at this time. Though we're hoping that we'll be able to identify some that we feel confident about in the future. Okay, so how does this conceptual structure thing work? Well, we think it's a hierarchical integration. We think that the reason that these lexical items emerge in the way that we have found them to emerge is because they're built upon one another. So I worked this example out myself with some of my students. So I'm going to argue from the very top of the scale, that you can't have a notion of validation until you also have the ability to think about confirming evidence. And so those two constructs, those two ideas, are prerequisites for the construction of a notion of validation. And similarly, that you can't really construct notions of confirming and evidence until you've got some kind of idea of how you can make comparisons and that involves some kind of criteria like logic or proofs, so that the constructions at the single abstractions order are necessary for the construction of confirming evidence at the abstract mappings order. And similarly, that you can't talk about making comparisons and logic and proofs until you can entertain doubt about facts. And you can't entertain doubt about facts until you can understand that it's possible to decide whether you believe or not believe. And similarly, that you can't determine whether you believe or not believe until you have an understanding that people can be wrong about what they know. So in the same way that what we can observe in the logical structure of a performance, in the relations between elements in a performance, is a hierarchical integration, we can observe that what happens in the elements themselves involves a hierarchical integration. And here is a map where I've used the color schemes. We're talking about validating evidence is a complex process involving evaluations of data gathering techniques, sources, and analytical methods. And the elements in red at the bottom are all second-order abstractions that are integrated in a system, a complex process, that leads toward the validation of evidence. Okay. So now that I've told you a little bit about the construct of hierarchical complexity, I'd like to address the question of whether we can actually claim that hierarchical complexity is like a ruler. So here's my hierarchical complexity ruler. Many of you have probably already seen Kurt Fischer's ruler. It looks more like a ruler. Mine looks like a line, and I've got my complexity orders strung out along it from sensory motor systems to single principles. At the top. So hopefully you'll be able to follow along here. I'm going to argue that it is like a ruler in many respects, though it's kind of an odd ruler in some respects. But I think it's like a ruler in the ways that we need it to be like a ruler in order to start speaking that common language I was talking about earlier. First of all, is hierarchical complexity content independent? We said that was one of the prerequisites of a ruler. Well, I'm going to argue that it is, in more than one way. You saw these examples before, these two different constructs of a good leader that we said are both at the same complexity order. They're both at abstract mappings. You can see the little arrows going out from abstract mappings. But they don't have the same content in them. The conceptual content is quite different. These are two very different constructs in terms of the content. And yet it's possible for us to use the ruler to say, yes, but they're still at both at the same complexity order. So just like we can say, here are two people, this one's 5'6" and this one's 6 foot tall, or they're both 5'6", we're not reducing those two people to this being the same thing. They're full of other kinds of content, other kinds of measurable things, but they do share that one dimension. They're both at the same height, or they're at different heights. We also can ask, is hierarchical complexity domain general? And this is another kind of content independence. And my answer again is yes, we can use this construct and this way of looking at texts and performances in any domain of knowledge. So here we have examples of reasoning in the domain of physical science and the domain of reasoning about good education. Both of them have exactly the same structure, or very similar structures. They both have this very linear quality, abstract concepts with relations between them in a kind of linear stepwise sequence. And yet they're about completely different things. But we can say with confidence, because we understand that their logical structure is the same, that they indeed both belong to the same complexity order. They both fit within this complexity order. And that's a very powerful thing, to have that kind of content and context independence. And then we have to ask, well, is hierarchical complexity an interval scale? Because we said it's not enough to be an ordinal scale. You have to have an interval scale in order to say you're actually measuring. Well, there are a couple of ways of thinking about whether hierarchical complexity is actually an interval scale. One of them is kind of an analytical perspective. And here the argument is that movement from any one complexity order to the subsequent order involves the same task demands. And what we mean by that is that each movement from one complexity order to the next involves exactly a movement of one complexity order, one hierarchical integration. So each move is defined in exactly the same way, even though there's a major change that takes place with each level. Each of the moves is defined in the same way. And there's another way of thinking about it, and that is from a more empirical perspective. And we've been gathering evidence, both Dr. Fisher and myself and other researchers have been gathering evidence that the processes of development appear to be the same in an empirical sense, no matter where you are on the continuum. The same kinds of processes seem to apply. So whether we're studying little children or we're studying adults who are developing, when we see development happening, it looks the same. It looks like the same processes are involved. Moreover, models of performance, I've been using the Roche model to model performance on this construct, show that the distance between complexity orders, at least in a probabilistic sense, appears to be the same no matter which interval you're looking at. So there's an interval quality there as well. So it may not be interval in the same way that we think about interval when we're looking at a ruler of a physical property, but there is a kind of intervalness that we can employ, and I think that it may be enough. Okay, so we also, of course, have to have methods for looking at the reliability and validity of any kind of measure, and here I'm not going to present I'm not going to present these data or this evidence here, but I can tell you a little bit about what we have done. We've looked at different kinds of validity. I think the most important kind of validity to look at from my perspective is construct validity. And what I mean by that is, do we see in behavior evidence that supports how we conceive of our construct? So if we've defined our construct and we say that development along this continuum should have certain kinds of properties based upon the definition of this construct, do we see evidence that in performance that behavior is consistent with this construct? And there have been a number of studies done over the last 30 years looking at construct validity in this, through this kind of lens. And so there's a great deal of evidence for construct validity here. There's also evidence for validity in terms of how this scale compares to other scales that measure development. For example, we've looked at how the use of the hierarchical complexity scale compares to the use of Kohlberg's standard issue scoring system, Armand's good life scoring system, Kitchener and King's reflective judgment system, and the Perry scheme. And what we find when we take a set of texts and we score them with both kinds of instruments is that it doesn't matter whether you're using the hierarchical complexity scoring scheme or one of these domain-dependent schemes. It turns out that a very large percentage of what you're looking at is the same construct. And because it turns out that hierarchical complexity is involved in all of these, and because hierarchical complexity is our instrument, we've concluded that it is hierarchical complexity that's the common dimension. And the beauty of this is that what this means is that you don't have to construct a new measure for every single domain, but that in fact you can use the same measure across domains, and that applies to what we're talking about when we're talking about content independence. There have also been a number of different kinds of reliability studies done. We've done a lot of inter-rater reliability work, and of course inter-rater reliabilities are calculated for pretty much every study that's been done over the last 30 years or so. And our work using this particular scoring scheme, we've done several studies of inter-rater reliability. And usually, up until recently, inter-rater reliabilities we've been calculating them in terms of one-third of a complexity order agreement. And right now, up until about 2 years ago, we were achieving between 85 and 95% agreements within a third of a complexity order, which, you know, we're starting to get a more fine-grained match between raters. Recently, though, this last year, we started to develop methods for actually assessing people's positions within complexity orders rather than just placing them within a complexity order. And this innovation has resulted in the ability to assess inter-rater agreement within one-fifth of complexity order. So we're talking about 85 to 90% agreement within one-fifth of a complexity order now, which means we're getting to much finer-grained distinctions between performances. And I think this is a very important development, because without finer-grained measures, we really have difficulty looking at things like transition processes and, you know, what's going on with Johnny from 1 month to the next rather than just from 1 year to the next. The other kind of reliability is psychometric reliability. And I think that this is sometimes neglected in the kind of research that we're doing, partly because usually when people do research using hierarchical complexity or skill theory, sample sizes are fairly small, and so it's difficult to model the data with psychometric techniques. But in our research, one of the things we've been doing is collecting very large data sets, and it just enables us to look at psychometric reliabilities. And what's fascinating is that psychometric reliability and inter-rater reliabilities are virtually identical. That the confidence that we can place in a score of an individual with our psychometric tests is about the same as the confidence we can place when we look at inter-rater reliability. So, and we haven't done psychometric reliability with our new version of the scoring system yet, but I'm really looking forward to finding out if indeed we do get even a finer reliability with the new system. Okay. Well, the last thing that was on the list of requirements for good measurement was the ability to calibrate the assessment. And I'm going to argue that calibration is something that can be accomplished with modern psychometric tools. We have tools at our disposal that will allow us to ask the questions of our instruments that we need to ask in order to determine whether they're doing the same thing from one context to another. And that's what's required for calibration. The other thing that I think applies to calibration is the emerging possibility of having automated objective measurements of hierarchical complexity. And while this isn't yet possible in looking at all types of data, we have developed a method for automating the measurement of hierarchical complexity in text performances. and we're hoping that that's going to be available to researchers and practitioners sometime relatively soon, though it takes a great deal of time to get these things out and on the market and usable. I'd like to also just make the call, maybe somewhat informally, for developmental psychologists to take seriously this business of calibration of instruments. If we are going to calibrate instruments as scientists, it has to be a team effort. It's not enough for one group of people to go out and do what myself and my team have been trying to do, for Fisher to go out and do the things he's been trying to do. We need a team of developmental psychologists to get together, figure out, you know, what the assessment's going to look like, what we're going to call the levels, how we're going to think about what they are, what kind of instruments we're going to use, to develop that common language that we can share so that we can make more meaning together and understand better the developmental processes that we're interested in studying. Okay, so let's talk about a little bit working with a developmental ruler. It's all fine and good to have a ruler, but I'm sure that most of us, when we think about doing developmental psychology, we're thinking about having some kind of meaningful effect in the world. And so the next step after you have identified your dimension and learned to measure it is to put it to work, and that's what we're trying to do in two different studies that are ongoing. In the first of these, we are working with the Springfield School District to look at conceptual development in physical science in the ninth grade. And that's our pure research objective, is to actually look at conceptual development. But then we're going to take what we learn about conceptual development in physical science, and we're working with the teachers to take that information and that knowledge that we're developing to work on developing curricula and scoring rubrics that the teachers can take back to the classroom. So we're using our instruments to actually help teachers in concrete ways to do a better job teaching physical science. And hopefully in the process also helping teachers to have a deeper understanding of their students' learning processes. So by helping them to develop rubrics, rather than thinking in terms of grades, we're encouraging them to think about, what does my student know now? Where do I want to take my student next? And what does learning look like at these different at the different levels that students are capable of working in? And the second project is the National Security Agency Leadership Study that Dr. Fisher and I are working on. And in this project, which is a fascinating, really, really fascinating and fun project, we're working on the development of leadership concepts, epistemology, and problem solving in management level people within the National Security Agency. And if you're wondering why this is necessary to do, one of the first things that our contact there said to me when I first met her is, we're a bunch of geeks, we're a bunch of introverts, our people skills aren't that good. And in order for us to take on leadership positions, we need to develop those skills and try to get them up to the level of our technical skills, which are very, very high indeed. So they were feeling a big crunch, especially after 9/11, when they had to promote a lot of people into management positions who really weren't ready with the management skills that are necessary. So in their leadership school, they really want to work to have targeted assessments and targeted interventions for people who are moving into leadership positions or who are in leadership positions and who are struggling. And the end goal of this, from their perspective, is to develop online assessments and a set of learning interventions for people in management. So, again, we're going to be using the ruler to study development in these domains, and then we're going to be using what we learn to develop real-life assessments and interventions. And then the other thing that they're interested in having us do, and this is just beginning to emerge, is an evaluation of their leadership programs. So they want to collect the data on how well these interventions are working to help them determine how effective the procedures that we're setting in place are for the agency. Now, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of results from these studies because they are ongoing, but we do have some preliminary results that I can talk to you about. This illustration, this ball illustration, is from the Springfield study. This semester we're looking at two areas in the curriculum. We asked the teachers, what are the hardest things for you to teach? What are the things the kids just aren't getting? And one of the things they said was, well, energy. We can't get them into energy. We need introductory stuff that gets them into the idea of energy and what energy is, and we're not making that transition. The other one that they are having a really difficult time with, even more difficulty, is waves. The students have a very hard time with waves. So we said, okay, we'll take these two things, and we will try to help you develop some curricula, and we will study what's actually happening with students developing understanding of these constructs. So one of the things that we've done is we've developed these what we call teasers. So we have this energy teaser, and we give it to the students before they have the lessons on energy, and then again after they have the lessons on energy. And a subset of the students are interviewed at length about their responses to these teasers. So in this particular example, we show them a picture of a hand holding a ball, and it's going to drop the ball. The ball hits the floor and bounces up. And in this illustration, it bounces up about halfway from where it started. And we ask them, well, what happens to the energy of the ball? And we ask them, what happens to it as it falls? What happens to it when it hits the floor? And what happens to it as it comes back up? And in addition to asking these 14-year-olds what's happening to the energy of the ball, we've also given this problem to some younger children and also some older adults, just because we wanted to understand what's going on before kids are 14 and then what goes on afterward. So in the rubrics that you're going to see later, we've incorporated some of the things we've learned from younger students as well. One interesting thing is that when you ask what happens to the energy of the ball, some students ask what happens to the ball. So the responses that we get are not always our responses to this question, because they don't have a conception of energy, so they just address the concrete object, the ball. Okay, so we have not yet developed this scoring rubric for teachers. This is an example of what a rubric might begin to look like based upon our preliminary observations of what's going on in these interviews. But I want to share these with you because I think what we've already learned is a complete surprise and shock to the teachers. This is not something that they've just intuited from their work with students. And so we've already provided them with some useful information, or able to provide them with some useful information about what's going on with students in classrooms. And I think these lead to some suggestions about what kind of interventions you can use. So at the first level that we've been able to describe, and for the teachers, we're not calling it representational mappings, we're calling it level one. We find that the students at this who are operating at this complexity order really don't understand how the word energy might apply to the ball. And usually they just ignore its existence. Or they'll say, huh, and we'll just say what happens to the ball because we want to get them started thinking about the situation. Their description of what's going on with the ball are in terms of usually a subset of the observable actions or attributes of the ball. I also should say that with the very young children, we actually held a ball in our hand rather than showing them a picture, because we thought that would help them to enter into the problem more easily. Well, actually, they had the picture too, but we held a ball, and we gave them the ball as a gift afterwards. And interestingly, some of these little kids would, after they answered the question, would take the ball and start experimenting on their own with what it actually did. Very interesting. The curiosity of the little guys was so much more than the curiosity of the older students. So here at the representational mappings order, if we hear terms like gravity or energy at all, they can't explain their use of them. Usually they can't explain it at all, and if they do, they only explain them in very concrete terms by referring back to the action of the ball or just saying, I don't know. At the next level, representational systems, or level two for the teachers, the student now can describe most or all of a series of actions of the ball as it falls and bounces, but the description's still in terms of the actions. Descriptions include observations about the ball's speed at different points in the process of falling and bouncing, and the word energy actually gets used a little bit now, but if it's used, it's equivalent to movement. So they might as well be saying movement because there's nothing else going on. It's just a word that means movement. More movement means more energy. And gravity appears to be conceptualized almost like a physical thing that pulls on the ball. So it's got a very concrete quality to it, their understanding of gravity at this point. At level three, energy is now conceptualized as something behind the ball for the first time. So there's this idea that's emerging that it's not just the movement of the ball we're talking about, but it's something that's behind the movement of the ball we're talking about. And this is apparent in the notion that energy can change from one state to another. So we start to get the term potential energy being used in some kind of meaningful way, not fully understood necessarily, but understood as energy without motion or motion about to happen. But the relationship between potential and kinetic energy, even if they talk about both concepts, there's no articulation of the relationship between the two at this level. They're not there yet. At level four, students begin to describe changes in the energy of the ball as a series of changes in state. So this is the first point. Level four abstract mappings is the first level at which they are beginning to talk about kinetic and potential energy, heat and sound, as inputs and outcomes or changes of state with respect to the activity actions of the energy of the ball. And they actually talk about these in terms of abstract forces like friction and gravity. If those terms are used at the previous orders, they're just used in an independent way. They're not tied to one another in any way. Here is where they begin to be tied to one another in relations. But they're single relations or series of relations. They're not described in terms of systems yet. So they'll talk about the change from potential to kinetic energy brought about by the release of the ball, but they won't connect that back to something else that's happened previously. It'll just be explained in a series. Finally, at the abstract systems order, or level five, the student describes the energy of the ball as a multivariate system in which energy is conserved. And so this is really the very first time when the notion of conservation of energy seems to be fully understood. Students may use the term at the lower complexity orders, but they can't talk about it as a system. But at the abstract systems level, they begin to talk about transformations between forms of potential and kinetic energy. And these are fully elaborated with all of the other things like elastic potential energy and gravitational potential energy. And, you know, all of the detail begins to be fleshed out and the relations between these things explored. Now, what's really interesting about this is that among our 14-year-olds, the average performance was at the single abstractions complexity order. But a large percentage, maybe up to 30% of the students in the sample, were thinking about energy at the representational systems order. And if you'll recall, at that order, at that level, energy and movement are the same thing. They don't have any kind of abstract conception of energy. So why were teachers having trouble getting kids into thinking about energy? Well, part of the problem is that they haven't abstracted energy as a concept from the physical actions or physical activities of the ball. And lo and behold, students who hadn't yet formed an abstract conception of energy almost made no progress in their learning during the unit, because the content of the unit is actually targeted at least at abstract mappings and sometimes at abstract systems, which is way, way beyond their ability to conceive, and they're just lost. Okay, another thing that we're going to be doing with the data from the Springfield study is we've been collecting data about the students' thinking in other domains as well as in the domain of physical science. So we're conducting interviews about good friendship, good leadership, what a good physical science class would be like, and their epistemology. And lo and behold, not very surprisingly to us, we find that most of these students actually think at a higher level about things related to their social lives than they do about things related to physical science. So in some ways this tells us, well, it's not that they're incapable of learning or moving to the next level. It has to do with experience in this world of physical science in some way, that they're not as engaged in it and they're not having as much experience in that world as they are in the social world. Another thing I'd like to point out here is look at this one ruler that we have, and that we have all of these other these domains strung out on, and we're actually able to look at a student's profile along this continuum and compare how they're doing in one domain versus another in a meaningful way, in a very meaningful way, because the points along the ruler mean the same thing no matter which domain the student's operating in. Okay, now I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the National Security Administration study. Here we have a different kind of ruler because the agency folks that we're studying are mostly cryptologists and mathematicians. They like numbers rather than names. So we've taken the names away from the levels and we replaced them with numbers. And here a 25 is equivalent to abstract mappings, a 30 is equivalent to abstract systems, and a 35 is equivalent to single principles. So you get the idea. In the NSA study, one of the things they want us to do is look at development in a variety of domains. So we have domains like problem solving, critical thinking, interpersonal skills, technical skills, and organizational skills. These are related to their management, what they call their ACE criteria, which are promotion criteria for people in management positions. And we're looking here at M1 promotion criteria. And what we've done is we've gone in and we've scored their promotion criteria with the hierarchical complexity scoring system. And we've said, well, to meet this particular criterion for problem solving, people would have to be at least at a highly elaborated abstract mappings level to be able to do what they're asking them to be able to do in the ACE criteria on that dimension. And so we've scored the M1 criteria, and lo and behold, the M1 criteria are really consistent with one another. I was surprised because they're not using this construct to develop these criteria, but the criteria are extremely consistent, with the exception of the technical skills category. And again, they're holding people to a much higher level in their requirements for technical skills than they have been for their requirements in interpersonal skills. So we can also do the same thing, use the hierarchical complexity scoring system to score employee performances and to look at how they are doing in terms of meeting these criteria. And what we find when we look at employee profiles is that many of them are not operating up to the level of the criteria for the very position that they're actually holding. So, for example, here we can compare the M1 criteria to the performance, and we can see that in problem solving, critical thinking, in particular, this particular employee is quite a bit behind the expectations for being promoted into the very level that they're already operating in. Now, the way that we've been planning on using this information is to give this information to only the employee to help them with their own development. When I first started working with the NSA, we wanted to make it very clear with them that we didn't feel comfortable with them using these profiles as criteria for hiring. But it's actually becoming very tempting for them to start to do that right now, and we're entering into some talks with them about what the implications are of using what we're doing as a way of determining whether someone's ready to move from one management position to another. So it's a more frightening scenario for us. But the idea originally, and one thing they're definitely going to still be doing is giving this feedback to the employee along with suggestions for, okay, now this is what you need to work on, and here are classes you can take, here are exercises you can do to help your development in these areas. The other thing that they've asked us to do is help them with program evaluation. And these are real data here. What we're looking at here is the relationship between the average developmental level of people at the M2 level, which is their middle management level, and the criteria for performance, or the ACE standards criteria for that level. So the red box represents the range for the M2 standard. We scored that standard too, and that's the range that our scores fell in for the M2 standards. And the little blue box represents the mean score for people who are in that level position within the organization. And the line around the blue box represents the range. So you can see fairly clearly here, and this is not that much of a surprise to them, but concerning to them, that what we're finding is that people are actually operating, for the most part, on average, at a level quite a bit lower than the levels that are required by the ACE standards. And this is something that the agency is really eager to address. I think the rest of the country is eager to address. Okay, so to finish up, I want to talk about whether indeed we actually have presented a yardstick for developmental science. Well, I think I've provided evidence that we have a unidimensional content and context-independent trait. And I also think that it's clear that we now have a system for assessing the amount of the trait and something that we can construe as being interval units. Further, we do have a method for evaluating the reliability, and are actually multiple methods for evaluating the reliability and validity of these assessments. And I think, I'm hoping, that we as a community have the will to begin to work on the calibration or standardization of this measure. Now, at the very beginning, I talked about ways in which I thought, I said that I was going to tell you about ways in which I think having a measure like this can really transform developmental science. Well, the first way is that it has the potential to be the basis for a common language of development, a common language that all of us working in developmental science can share, can speak, and can work within. Second, it provides us with the possibility of doing much more accurate and content and context independent developmental assessments than we have been able to do prior to the identification of this construct. One of the things it allows us to do is meaningfully look at the impact of context on development. That was part of my argument at the beginning, but just imagine, think about Carol Gilligan's critique of Kohlberg's moral judgment system, where she argued that his system was more effective in looking at the development of moral reasoning in men than in women, that women had a different way of thinking. Well, if you really want to look at whether women have a really different way of thinking from a developmental point of view, you need a ruler so that you can say, well, okay, given that they're both at level 5, what are the differences in the way that they think? And in none of the research presented by Gilligan and her colleagues were they able to do this, because they had two different rulers, one for Kohlberg's system, one for their system. And when you're and no way of knowing whether they were really talking about the same level across those two different rulers. So until you've parsed out that developmental dimension, you can't really meaningfully look at those contextual differences. Also, having a good ruler provides us with the opportunity to construct very rich descriptions of alternative pathways. Now, how does this work? Well, the methodology that we've developed for looking at conceptual development allows us to look at the concepts separate from the structure. So we can assess the hierarchical complexity of a performance with a degree of independence of the particular conceptual content. In a way, we don't care what that particular conceptual content is when we score for hierarchical complexity. What that means is that to some extent, or to a great extent, the hierarchical complexity observation is independent of the observation of its particular conceptual content. So we go and we look at the conceptual content in a different kind of analysis. We conduct a detailed analysis of the conceptual content. And only after we've done these two independent observations do we put the two back together again. And this gives us the possibility of constructing very rich descriptions of what's going on in conceptual development within and across persons. And if we want to look at conceptual development and alternative pathways, this is a methodology that affords that opportunity. It's very difficult to say something's an alternative pathway, again, unless you know that both are at level 5 or both are at level 3, moving to level 4. Very difficult. The other thing that I would argue that could be a transformation for developmental science is that if we have good measures, we can construct better models of developmental processes. Remember, I was talking to you before about dynamic systems models. they absolutely require good measures. If you've got huge error terms or you have low reliability, the models that you construct using these complex mathematical models rapidly become meaningless. So we need these well-calibrated measures for doing these kinds of models. Now, another thing that I think that is a very important contribution of having good measures in behavioral science is that it's bound to increase the communication between behavioral and physiological branches of science. And one of the problems that neuropsychologists talk about with respect to the behavioral sciences is that there aren't any measures. There's nothing that we can bring to them and offer them in terms of behavior that they can actually hold on to and compare what they're getting from their imaging techniques and all of their studies of brain activity to see in some meaningful way what's going on between behavior and brain activity and from a developmental point of view. All of the developmental studies that have been done so far are just completely age-dependent. Age is used as a proxy for development. And then the last thing that I think that the last transformation that I'd like to talk about is really the end goal of all of the work that we're doing in developmental science, and that is that we want to improve learning environments. We want to improve learning for students. And I think that because we can improve all of these other things with good measures, we can begin to improve learning environments. But not only that, this is a ruler that's not only useful as a way of doing research in developmental psychology, but this is a ruler that can be used in doing assessments of students. We can say Johnny's at level 2 right now, and our goal this year is to get Johnny to level 3 in this domain. And we can talk meaningfully about what that means in terms of the content that needs to be required in a given domain. We can talk about what that means in terms of the learning approach we're going to take with Johnny. Much more meaningful than an A, B, or a C to be able to place that child on a developmental continuum within a range and talk about what needs to be done to help move that particular student along the developmental continuum.